You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at the issues that are shaping the 2020 presidential race and the ones that get voters motivated, and we'll ask you what issues you want to hear candidates talking about. First, many Democratic presidential hopefuls are calling for President Trump's impeachment following the release of special counsel Robert Mueller's redacted report investigating the 2016 election. But some key Democratic figures say the party shouldn't rush toward impeachment, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and presidential hopeful Joe Biden. One Republican congressman, Justin Amash of Michigan, is joining some of those on the left in calls for impeachment proceedings. But what does it take to impeach a president, and how does the process work? Our next guest joins us to talk about what impeachment proceedings have looked like in the past and how those precedents could impact the Trump administration. Ken Mayer is a University of Wisconsin-Madison political science professor. His research focuses on Congress and the American presidency. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be with you.
Well, we hear definitions of impeachment in the Constitution. Do they set a very clear bar of what it takes to be worthy of impeachment?
Short answer, no. The provisions regarding impeachment, like a lot of the interesting provisions in the Constitution, are ambiguous. They have not really been fleshed out. And ultimately, the major issue is that it is a political process. The Constitution specifies in Article 2 that the president, the vice president, and other civil offices are subject to impeachment for treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. The meaning of treason and bribery are clear enough. The meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors is not. There are a number of precedents. I think there have been 19 individuals, mostly federal judges, who've been impeached, mostly for crimes like bribery or obstruction or perjury. But the consensus, actually, it's not really a consensus, it's a basic fact, is that an actual crime is neither a necessary nor a sufficient condition for impeachment. Congress does not need to have evidence of an actual crime to impeach, and clear evidence or even a conviction is not by itself sufficient evidence to impeach.
Right. So a Congress could say this president's just doing a terrible job, for example, and hypothetically, if they could get enough members of Congress to agree on it, they could impeach a president for that reason.
Technically, yes, although
doesn't seem likely, but
policy differences are generally not accepted as a reason for impeaching.
All right, let me throw this at you. Andrew Johnson, I mean, wasn't his impeachment over Reconstruction in part of a policy difference? Again, he wasn't removed from office by impeachment.
That's correct. The formal reason for impeaching Johnson was violations of what was called the Tenure in Office Act that required a president, when he fired certain executive branch officials, he couldn't do that unless or until the Senate had actually confirmed a successor. And he fired the Secretary of War, and that was the first, I think, 8 articles of impeachment were regarding that, which members of the House regarded as illegal. But it was clearly dissatisfaction over how he was handling Reconstruction. And there's another piece of it, which is the 9th article of impeachment charged Johnson with, among other things, making speeches with the intent to, quote, attempt to bring into disgrace, ridicule, hatred, contempt, and reproach the Congress of the United States. Huh. And that's not something that would likely pass muster now, but there is not a formal checklist that Congress has to go through. Gerald Ford said in 1974 that an impeachable offense is whatever a majority of the House thinks it is. Ken Starr was quoted as saying if Congress wanted to impeach a president for poisoning the neighbor's cat, they could do it.
Now, let's go through the procedure a little bit. Take a step by step. What happens in an impeachment process?
Well, the only thing that is formally required is a resolution or a piece of legislation passed in the House that specifies that the president or some other officer is impeached. And there are precedents that Congress goes to. It takes the form of a resolution. There are actually a handful of impeachment resolutions that have already been submitted. They're not going anywhere, but they specify the reasons, once an impeachment resolution is enacted, there are House managers who were appointed to essentially serve as prosecutors in the trial in the Senate. The Chief Justice serves as the presiding judge in a Senate trial, and impeachment is the formal bringing of charges. The trial is conducted by the Senate, and upon a two-thirds vote in the Senate, the official or president would be removed from office.
Talking to Ken Mayer, UW-Madison political science professor, looking at the hows, whys, and wherefores of the impeachment process. I want to give a listen to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She has not jumped right on board with impeachment here. Here's a listen to what she had to say recently.
It's an indictment. So when you're impeaching somebody, you want to make sure you have the strongest possible indictment, because it's not the means to the end that people think.
So what are your reactions to that and other comments we've heard from House Speaker Pelosi?
Well, she's really resisting calls. As of this morning, there was a head count. I think there were 59 or 60 members of the Democratic caucus who had come out in public, either in favor of impeachment or beginning impeachment inquiries. Pelosi is resistant. It's really not going to happen without her without her go-ahead. And it reflects the fact that this is a political judgment, that there's no question that impeachment is a grave step, and it is not something to be taken lightly. I think what her comments are reflecting is the fact that it's not in the Democrats' interest to pursue this without having a clear statement that the public accepts of what the charges are. So I don't think that her current position is going to be an absolute barrier. It depends on – there are a number of things that could happen over the course of the next 18 months or so that could change that calculation. But she really is pushing back quite hard, and it's not going to happen without her approval.
You mentioned the phrase impeachment inquiry, and that is something that some House Democrats are talking about. We want to start an impeachment inquiry process. That doesn't mean that they say we are going to proceed with an impeachment vote. Is that a thing with a legal definition that empowers the Congress to do things that it can't currently do?
Well, actually, possibly. That an impeachment inquiry, it's just hearings, and there's nothing magic about that statement. The investigations that the Judiciary Committee and the House Intelligence Committee and the Energy and Commerce Committee are holding about taxes and asking William Barr to provide an unredacted copy of the Mueller report, these are all things that could eventually be folded into an impeachment process. But one of the interesting technical questions is there is a statute that very clearly gives Congress or the chair of the Ways and Means Committee the authority to request anybody's tax returns. And the law is quite specific that upon a written request by the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, the secretary shall furnish the tax returns. The Secretary of Treasury has refused to do that, arguing that Congress doesn't have a, quote, legitimate legislative purpose in asking for the president's tax returns. And there's some legal scholars who think that if it actually was be part of an impeachment inquiry, that by definition is a proper legislative function and would mean that objection to providing the taxes would no longer be valid. So there are some things that an impeachment inquiry would give Congress perhaps some additional legal authority to demand documents and to subpoena testimony. But we're really kind of in uncharted territory here.
Right. Some judges have been skeptical of that idea of no legislative need on these. I think people point toward the oversight role of Congress as a need in and of itself. But I guess the thought of an impeachment inquiry is, hey, maybe for some judges on the borderline, that impeachment inquiry would be a stronger case than just that committee subpoena?
Possibly. I don't think there are a lot of objective observers who think that the Trump administration's blanket refusal to accept any kind of congressional oversight is going to hold up in court. But that takes a lot of time and gets folded into a messy litigation process. And an impeachment inquiry might clarify some of that. But again, it's not a lot of these questions are going to be in terms of the document production and compelling testimony and subpoenas are going to be resolved by the courts in any event.
We're talking to Ken Mayer right now, UW-Madison political science professor. His research focuses on Congress and the American presidency. He's with us to talk about presidential impeachment, what it means, how it works, and how it fits the latest conversations about President Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to make a case for or against impeachment or impeachment inquiry proceedings related to President Trump? You want to make a political, moral, or ethical case one way or the other? Let us know. Do you think Congress has a duty in this case to keep the administration in check? Do you worry about political fallout, whichever side of the aisle you might be on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about presidential impeachment with Ken Mayer, a UW-Madison political science professor who specializes in presidential and congressional research. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the impeachment process, what it takes, how it works? Do you think there's a case for impeachment of President Trump? Why or why not? Do you want to see Congress start proceedings, whether aiming for a vote or just to have an inquiry into possible impeachment? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ken, there's a lot of concern about political fallout from possible impeachment. People point back toward 1998, President Clinton, Republicans in the House impeached him. The Senate ended up keeping him in office. People say, oh, look how bad that was for Republicans. Other people lately have been saying, yeah, so bad they ended up with the presidency and control of both houses of Congress 2 years later. How do we measure the political fallout of an impeachment attempt?
Well, there are a couple of schools of thought on this that a colleague and I wrote about the Clinton impeachment years ago, and we described the strangeness of it as, you know, there was no question that Clinton behaved miserably and lied about what had happened. And so, of course, it makes perfect sense that the major consequence was that two Republican speakers of the House lost their jobs. It was also 1998 was the first midterm election in over 60 years where the president's party actually picked up seats, and that led to Newt Gingrich's resignation. And so one way of looking at that is, aha, there are great risks and peril for a party, a House that impeaches a president unless there is overwhelming consensus, as there would have been or there was with Nixon at the end of his term, that a president had lost the public and had lost the support of even their own party. But that's a political judgment, and that is something that is inherent in the impeachment process. This is not a legal inquiry or a legal process where you have you have standards of evidence that are universally accepted and external reviews and checks with the judiciary presiding and serving as a check on abuse. This is all Congress. They can do what they want. They have historical and they have precedential standards, but it's not as if they can or even were meant to ignore the political consequences of the impeachment process. I mean, you can go back and look at what Hamilton wrote in the Federalist Papers, saying this is a political process that needs to be in place to protect the public interest and the public order, and that makes it something different than a criminal prosecution.
Let's bring on a caller now. Gwen is with us in Madison. Gwen, hello.
Hello. I'd like to just make a comment. I don't think that the Democrats should attempt to impeach the president. I believe that the younger members who are less politically savvy are being manipulated by the Republicans, because there is no way that this would be confirmed through the Senate or through the judiciary. The Supreme Court has been stacked to the conservative side. The senators are primarily Republicans, and this is just a way to convince the Democrats and the liberals to go after a wild goose chase. And instead of doing that, I believe they should focus on the election and on their party platform that deals with things that are important to the general public.
Gwen, I'm going to jump in. Thanks so much for that call. Gwen is on board with many Democrats here saying, let's remove President Trump from office at the ballot box.
Well, she identified the divergence here. For a Democrat who sees Trump as a existential threat to Democratic institutions and is insistent on getting rid of him, the choices are defeat him at the ballot box in 2020 or try to impeach. Well, the impeachment process is very unlikely to actually result in his removal, because that would take 67 votes in the Senate. Democrats would have to pick up at least 20 votes, and that seems vanishingly unlikely at this point. There's also a school of thought that says that an impeachment resolution, or actually impeaching the president, would trigger enough of a backlash that would actually be in his political interest, and it could mobilize his supporters and increase the probability that he's going to win in 2020. And again, that's one of the political judgments that the members of the House and the leadership have to make. There, you can argue just as articulately on the other side that a clear statement of the president's impeachable offenses would sway public opinion. But those are the options. And I think the Pelosi's resistance so far reflects that.
Let's go to a caller now. Tom is with us in Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Hi. My question is this, and I would appreciate a follow-up. Impeachment for what? What exactly would you have the president impeached for? Winning the election? Russian bots saying that Hillary Clinton had body odor? I don't get it. What would he be impeached for?
Tom, thanks for the call. What are some of the grounds for impeachment that people are bringing up?
Well, if you look at what the Democratic proponents are saying, I mean, there's plenty of evidence from the Mueller report, focusing specifically on the second volume, which talks about the obstruction, the acts of obstruction. There is plenty there for a supporter of impeachment to look at and justify. There are proponents who are pointing to claims that the president is violating the Emoluments Clause by profiting off of foreign business. There's plenty there. This is not simply a matter of Democrats who are unhappy that they lost the election. There's more substance to the problem, or substance to the claims. But again, this is not. It's not a matter of looking to one act and you say, aha, and that's it, and it triggers the process. It's much more complicated than that, and the political consequences have to be taken into account.
Tom, thanks for the call. I want to give a listen to Congressman, we mentioned earlier, Justin Amash, the lone Republican on board. Here's what he said at a recent town hall.
I'm confident that if you read Volume 2, you will be appalled at much of the conduct. And I was appalled by it. And that's why I stated what I stated. That's why I came to that conclusion, because I think we can't let conduct like that go unchecked.
So Volume 2, you had just mentioned in the Mueller report, obstruction is a big issue in that?
All of Volume 2 addresses claims and instances of possible obstruction. And the Mueller laid out 10 examples, or 10 sets of circumstances. And so far, Amash is the only Republican member of the House who has come out in favor of an impeachment inquiry. That's actually not necessary for the House to actually impeach. Democrats have a majority. That's what it would take. But I think the one fear or reluctance is, if this is seen as a purely partisan act, It increases the likelihood that Democrats will be in an analogous situation to the Republicans in 1998.
Let's bring on another caller now. Frank is with us in La Crosse. Frank, hi.
Hi. Clearly, the Clinton impeachment and the potential Trump impeachment underline how impeachment is a political and partisan process. And what needs to be rethought or reconsidered is the Department of Justice determination that they can't indict a sitting president. If he serves a second term or goes beyond the statute of limitations, or simply the fact that if there's truly a criminal action happening at the level of the executive office, the idea that you can't indict a sitting president is ridiculous, which means that the political process, being what it is, is left to flail in the wind.
Frank, thanks a lot for the call. And that's Robert Mueller at least definitely said, yeah, we can't charge the president with a crime. We're not even really going to talk about that. That's up to Congress. Frank saying maybe it shouldn't be that way.
What Frank was referring to is that there are two opinions that policy positions that the Department of Justice has taken that says a sitting president, as a matter of policy, cannot be indicted. It's not a judicial, it's not a Supreme Court opinion. It's not clear what the answer is. And what this comes down to is that the impeachment process exists alongside the criminal process, and ultimately, what the conclusion of the Mueller report is: here's the evidence that was laid out. What happens now has to be through this separate process. He didn't actually use precisely that mm-hmm. language, but it was pretty clear when he gave a statement last week that that's what he meant. That it's not. We don't know what the answer to the question is of whether a sitting president can be indicted. But it's also pretty clear that, as envisioned by the framers, the authors of the Constitution, that it was not designed to replace the criminal process, but exists alongside it.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks for that call. And Ken, thanks a lot for coming up today.
My pleasure.
That's Ken Mayer, UW-Madison political science professor. He was with us to talk about presidential impeachment, what it means, how it works, and how it fits in with conversations about President Trump. You know what's coming in 516 days? The 2020 presidential election. So far, 23 Democrats have entered the race. President Trump is also facing a primary challenge from former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld. A lot can happen between now and Election Day, but suppose we were headed to the polls today. We're not going to ask you which candidate you'd vote for, but we want to know what issue is most important to you and why. What do you want to hear candidates talking about? What kind of things do you want to hear from them on that issue? Is it the economy, climate change, immigration, abortion, foreign policy, gun control, health care, tariffs, criminal justice, voting rights, racism, police accountability, terrorism, opioids? The list goes on and on. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Mordecai Lee is a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. Mordecai, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, let me ask you a fundamental question at odds with our conversation here today. Do voters really vote on issues?
You know, I think the answer is yes and no. In other words, there are some people who say, this is my number one priority. I don't care if it's a Democrat or Republican. I don't care if it's a liberal or conservative. I'm going to vote for the person who does X. And, for example, if you go back to Prohibition, there was a chunk of voters, it was probably about 10% of the population, who literally did that. And so the pro-Prohibition candidate often won simply because of that. Or anti-prohibition candidate lost. So I really like the way you framed it in your introduction. In other words, we're asking voters not just to tell us what they care about or what are the things that are important, but really what is the click? What is the thing that's going to change their mind? What would make them vote for this candidate rather than that candidate? And naturally, there are voters out there who will always vote for one party or the other, who are always ideologically on the left or on the right. But this program, this theme, is trying to identify the people who are swing voters and who will decide based on a particular issue.
Well, I'm also asking listeners this because of a past conversation we had with Jay Rosen, journalism professor, talking about how we in the media talk about these things and try. And he suggested, hey, go to your audience, see the things they want to hear about. Do you think we in the media, and media, you know, that covers a lot of ground, but do you think we in the media do enough to get these kind of conversations, these kind of issue-oriented conversations out of our candidates?
Well, I think one of the problems is probably polling, and I'm not bashing pollsters, but usually what happens in a standard polling question is they ask people, of the following X number of topics I'm going to mention, what are the five most important to you? Or they'll say, what's the most important to you? And then they'll rank them. Here are the five most important. And I think that sort of makes us lose the sense of what really, really is important. And naturally, there are going to be people who are going to have those kinds of positions. But the media, in a sense, can't cover something unless it's clearly defined. And so I think the media isn't necessarily at fault. I've said before that I think the media is at fault for always loving horse race versus policy stories. But this question is a slightly different issue.
Let's bring on our callers now at 800-642-1234. We'll start with Jim in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. You know, we're a lot of talk about income disparity and things like that. I'm wondering if your guest can name the one city of the top 20 worst cities for homelessness and crime that is not run by a Democrat.
Wow, you know, that's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. And I'm guessing that Jim's underlying question or follow-up question is that he'd like to suggest that there's a theme that perhaps Democrats are doing, are mayors in cities that are doing badly, and perhaps Republicans are mayors in cities doing well. So that may well be a very important issue to Jim to decide what party or what candidate he wants to vote for.
Thanks for the call, Jim. We'll go now to Troy in Muskego. Troy, hi.
Hello. My thing I see happening is, I don't know why, but there's this big misconception about socialism. And what I think needs to happen is there's like what they call socialist governments, and we are not a socialist government. I am a democratic socialist, and that was what built the middle class. And the reason why I bring this up is because I actually had to educate my own father on this, because he was talking about Bernie Sanders saying, oh, he's a socialist. And I said, no, he's a democratic socialist, because my dad's like pro-union. He believes in like paying your taxes and those public schools and all that. That's democratic socialism. And I think people are very confused about the difference between a democratic socialist and a socialistic government.
Troy, thanks a lot for the call. And this is something interesting, Mordecai. I think for a long period of American history, like all of just about, to have a major party candidate use the S word as any part of a self-description, socialism, just wouldn't happen, right?
That's a real breakthrough that Bernie Sanders accomplished. And in fact, if you go back to American history and you look at the years of the fear of communism, go to the 1920s, go to the late 40s, early 50s, politicians on the right use socialism and communism as synonyms. And I think most of your listeners understand that there is a difference between communism and socialism, and that socialism used to be a relatively legitimate political party, but indeed it faded until Bernie Sanders brought it back. And again, the underlying issue that I think for voters, perhaps for Troy, perhaps for other listeners, is what is the proper role of government that they see, that they want a candidate who will define the role of government as, you know, fill in the blank, smaller government, less government, or perhaps more government and perhaps even increased taxes.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Mordecai Lee, professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker. We are asking you this question about the 2020 presidential race. What issue do you want to hear candidates talking about? What kind of plans do you want to hear from them? Is there an issue that really sways your vote in a primary, in a general election? Or do you look for something else? Are you looking for leadership, character, some kind of intangible that may not be directly related to one issue? Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Back to your calls now. Mark is with us in New Berlin. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Say, if the economy wasn't doing as good as it is, it would be that. If we had a chance of doing anything at all about global warming, we can't because India and Russia control the amount of carbon dioxide going in the atmosphere. Border security is my issue. I think we can't have an open border and allow any number of people to come into the country without any idea why we can. Can we let 1 million people a year in? Can we let 10 million people a year in? Border security is my issue.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. And it seems like, Mordecai, that's what candidate Donald Trump really pitched his campaign on when he ran for president in the congressional midterms. He's hoping there's a lot of people out there along the same lines.
I really like Mark's comment because he did he put in a conditional. He said, if the economy continues to do well. And what I really like about that comment is that in times of prosperity, to a certain extent, we have the luxury to then focus on the next issue. And he said for him, the next issue is border security. But implied by his comment was that if the economy were to tank, then voter opinion may well swing in a significant way. I think when we look at the election that Obama won, the economy suddenly tanked, the stock market collapsed, and John McCain just had no chance of winning the election. So the economy in that respect becomes the prevalent issue if there's a change in it. So I really like Mark's observation.
Thanks for the call, Mark, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Robert now in Milwaukee. Robert, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to bring up, Robert?
So I'm 20 years old. The 2016 presidential election was my first time voting. And I think investment in education and investment in young people is the most important thing on the ticket for me.
Robert, thanks for the call. A lot of education spending issues end up at the state level, and we're in a bit of a wrinkle about that here in Wisconsin, a lot of back and forth. On the national level, Mordecai, do you see a lot of attention to that?
Well, on the national level, there's a major role that the federal government plays. I think the kind of coverage that President Trump's Secretary of Education gets on her policymaking about private schools and indebtedness and things like that are good indications that education is a federal issue. So Robert is also hinting that not only is education important to him, but he thinks that it may well be important to a generation of voters, to the first generation that gets to vote in a presidential election. And based on the size of that generation and the percent of them who vote, that could well become an important and salient issue.
Let's go now to Jeff with us in Superior. Jeff, hello.
Hello, I'm concerned about our energy future. I know that we have natural resources in our country, and our population has grown tremendously in my lifetime, over doubled. And I'd like to own an electric car someday, but we don't have the infrastructure in Wisconsin anyway to support that. And I'm concerned about these presidential candidates expressing in a position about how we're going to approach our energy needs in the future.
Jeff, thanks for the call. And we've seen that with some candidates. President Trump moving more toward fossil fuels, a range of solutions here from Democrats on energy issues, Mordecai.
Right. I think Jeff hinted that he cares about energy supplies and tilts perhaps to an environmental perspective or environmental protection perspective. Naturally, there are people on the right and people on the left who have concerns about energy, but they end up on different sides in terms of the specific policy. Is it more to focus on extractive resources or more to focus on sustainable resources? So I suspect that Jeff is indicating that the condition of the environment, including energy supplies, adequate energy supplies for the future, are an important issue. And certainly in Wisconsin, the environment and conservation have always been important issues politically here.
We're talking about the issues shaping the 2020 presidential race. Mordecai Lee is with us, professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. We are wanting to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What issue do you want to hear presidential candidates talking about? What kind of things do you want to hear from them? What questions do you think they need to answer? What do you think needs to be on a debate stage? And is there an issue that drives your vote? Or is it just a D or R next to the name? How about at a primary? How do you make up your mind? And is it something other than an issue? Is it the character, the leadership, that kind of thing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the issues that are shaping the presidential race. Mordecai Lee is our guest, professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What issue do you think is the most important in this presidential race? What do you want to hear the candidates talking about? What questions should be posed to them by the media in the debate formats? Is there an issue that decides your vote, or is there something else about a candidate that makes you want to vote for them or against them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. John is with us in West Bend. John, hi.
Hello. I'd just like to talk about getting the impact of money out of politics. That's a decider for me. I can't for the life of me see why it costs $15 to $20 million to become a senator from our state. You know, and now that the political industry has become 24 hours a day, every day, every year, no matter if there's an election or not. And I don't think it's good for us. Money is not a vote.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Mordecai, we hear a lot from our callers about money in politics. Is this something we hear from candidates, presidential candidates in particular?
I wouldn't be surprised if this really rises on the hit parade of issues as we get closer to the election. And probably a slightly broader take on the issue, not just money in politics, as John mentioned it, but sort of the structural issues that lead to integrity of the democratic process. And by that, I'm sort of sliding towards the issue of reapportionment and redistricting, public financing of elections, things like that. There have been times in America, and I especially during the progressive era at the beginning of the last century, where there was huge mobilization of citizens in support of government reform, such as civil service reform. I think it's possible that John is hinting that there may well be a constituency that does that in the next presidential election.
Thanks a lot for the call. Going out to Jim with us in Brookfield. Jim, hello.
Hello, Rob. Mordecai, always good to hear you. My issues are somewhat related. Healthcare with gun violence. I think somebody needs to step up and really address gun violence and, of course, healthcare with the pre-existing. And then the environment, protect the environment, you know, air quality, water quality, and somewhat related to that would be climate change.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Jim gave us a lot there. Mordecai, first of all, healthcare. Now, people saw that maybe as a deciding issue in the midterms in 2018.
You know, I think what's going on, based on the list that we heard from Jim and then from some of the earlier callers, is that sometimes the way that a caller will define an issue indicates to us if they're likely tilting left or likely tilting right. I suspect that Jim, from what he indicated, probably is tilting towards a D, and he's looking for a candidate who really will reflect those priorities. Earlier, when we had the call from Mark about border security, I think just the definition of the issue, calling it by the name border security, hints that he's tilting to the right. And so what we're seeing here from the list so far this half hour is a lot of the subjects by themselves, by their very title, are hinting where the predilection of that voter is.
Thanks a lot for that call. And our caller mentioned gun violence as an issue. We've seen the NRA noted as a powerful lobby with members who like to vote and vote on their behalf. Do you see, since the Parkland shooting and the survivors there organizing, do you see a switch and more political activism on that side of the debate than we had in the past?
Well, generally speaking, in American politics, we see issues rise and fall, and we see powerful interest groups rise and then fall. So it's probably inevitable that sooner or later there's going to be a candidate who, let's say, hypothetically, will take on the NRA, make that a major issue, and then perhaps win. And that might be an indication that gradually American public opinion is changing from where it's been up to now. But up to now, the NRA has been very powerful politically. I think it is comparable to the example I mentioned at the top of the show, to the prohibition candidates and prohibition movement about 100 years ago.
Thanks a lot for that call. We are taking your calls on the issues that are important to you in the presidential race, what you want to hear candidates talking about along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Mordecai Lee with us from UW-Milwaukee. Back to your calls now. Ann is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Ann. Ann, are you there? Nope. Okay, let's try Kevin with us in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hi, I'd like to hear a return to discussion and debate of issues, and I'm sick and tired of the personal attacks, the political ideology, he said, they stand for, they hate this. Thanks, I'll take it off the air.
Kevin, thanks for the call. So Mordecai, sick of the mudslinging and the name-calling on the one hand, but also sick of the ideology. It's kind of hard to separate those out sometimes.
You know, at the beginning of the show, we talked about how some people are motivated based on an issue. Some people are motivated by other things. Their political ideology, their tilt, sort of what they inherited from their family in terms of partisan affiliation. I think if we look at American history, there's always been a constituency that Kevin mentions, and that says, let's focus on the issues. But at the same time, you could go back through American history, there's always been political campaigns simultaneously that focused on whether it's mudslinging or character assassination. You know, for example, the things they said about President Adams by the Jeffersonians, or the things that Democrats said about President Lincoln, would just make your hair stand on end in terms of mudslinging. But that's always been part of American politics. There's no test that says to a citizen, you can only decide who to vote for based on X and not Y. They can vote for anybody based on any reason they want to.
Thanks for the call. Mark joins us now in Three Lakes. Mark, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I am trying to figure out why nobody talks about senior citizens that live on a fixed income. They have educated us our whole life. And why are they ignored?
Mark, thanks for the call. So issues facing seniors in particular on a fixed income, Mordecai.
Well, indeed, issues for senior citizens were so major in American politics a generation ago. It led to Social Security, and then it led to Medicare. And I think Mark is right that the issue is gradually faded. But the percentage of senior citizens who are now in the population compared to non-senior citizens is growing. And I think it's inevitable that some politician is going to see sort of gold, is going to think that's a major gold strike by focusing on the issue that Mark mentioned. So I wouldn't be surprised if that issue arises sort of out of left field in the future.
Thanks a lot for the call. Mordecai, in our last minute or so, do you have advice for listeners who are maybe starting to pay attention to this election, trying to figure out who they're on board with? How can we as ordinary citizens do our homework here?
Well, I think that's a great question. And I guess I'd encourage people to think about, what do you care about? Not just an issue that you have a view on, but what do you really care about? What might make you change who you vote for based on that issue? And I think that's 99% of the way they would improve our democracy.
We'll leave it there. Mordecai, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Anytime, Rob. Thank you.
That's Mordecai Lee, professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. We talked to them about the issues the 2020 presidential candidates have been focusing on and which ones can motivate voters. And we've been taking your calls. Thanks for all of your input. You can keep it going. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the Vietnamese girl who was in a famous photograph of a napalm attack now works to promote peace around the world. She's speaking in Wisconsin this weekend. She joins the show to share her story. The Great Lakes are headed toward high waters, with Lake Superior on track to set records. We'll find out what that means for people who live on or visit the shores of the Great Lakes and what the rest of the season holds for water levels. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday with a taste of cooking from Appalachia. We'll talk to the author of the new cookbook, Smoke, Roots, Mountain, Harvest, Recipes, and Stories Inspired by My Appalachian Home. That and a look at some of the top news stories of today, of the week, I should say, from around Wisconsin. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.